It's funny, I was just thinking of renting Man in the Wilderness, the 1971.
Yeah.
Richard Harris stars in the Hugh Glass role. And
right.
The director is Richard Sarafian, and it was shot in Spain in the Andalusian hills, which doesn't exactly match the original locale where the Hugh Glass saga took place.
No, it's a very different movie. I remember we ran it on Z Channel, and it was I remember catching it back then in the 80s and enjoying it a great deal. It was more of a survival and revenge story. Without the ice so much, it was more just the guy being left for dead and coming back, you know.
But if you look at the trailer that I happened to post today, you see the following. And I'm saying this to those, obviously, who haven't seen The Revenant. Very few have.
But right.
The Revenant has an Indian attack on some guys who are basically trappers out there looking for pelts.
Right.
It has a, running from Indians, and it has a guy who's kind of the central figure, obviously a major figure as far as John Huston's character is concerned.
He wears a big stovepipe hat and is on a boat that's on wheels.
It has the bear. The bear almost kills him. They decide to leave him for dead and bury him, which is what happens in both films. A lot of it is there, at least as far as the trailer is concerned.
Yeah, the basic beats are there. And I think, you know, when we saw the film, what impressed me the most about The Revenant was that even things that I was resisting about it as a critic worked in the movie's favor, ultimately. Which is to say, you know, at times I'm thinking, gosh, this movie's running a bit long, or gosh, there's an awful lot of shots of Leonardo DiCaprio recovering his ability to walk, things like that. But I felt, ultimately, that those reiterations in silence, or, you know, with the sound and, you know, with image and so forth, but without dialogue, those things accrued in a way that gathered force and helped me feel like I was living the film. Because, you know, The Revenant is a very experiential movie. You know, I didn't feel like I was watching the movie, I felt like I was living it, particularly that bear attack.
The bear attack is
so amazingly well done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, when Elvis Mitchell had everybody up there, I was sad that he ran out of time and didn't get to talk about just that, because there is a lot of the excellence of the film. I'm pretty jaded to special effects, and I can usually smell them, and I was so involved in the scene that I was not seeing any of the technique with which it was done. And
I didn't sense any technique. Now, I think that what I heard is that it was a guy in a bear suit, in a CG bear suit, you know, the kind that can be obviously augmented with realistic looking fur and whatnot. But did you hear that also? Guy in a bear suit?
No, I didn't. And I wish I would have, that's why I wish I would have loved that if they talked about it. You don't want to spoil the magic, but the fact is that I wondered from the standpoint of, say, Leonardo DiCaprio, because what I felt watching him in that scene is what I felt with one particular moment with Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven, which there's a moment when he's so torn up in Unforgiven that he speaks in a very frail voice, and like he's afraid he's about to die. And it's a very vulnerable moment, a really iconic moment of vulnerability in Eastwood's career, because you really feel what a good actor he is. I mean, he is. You're so inside that moment, you're not even seeing the acting. It's just only in retrospect that I realize how great that little bit is. And the same goes for DiCaprio here, because, you know, he has, that bear attack is an opera with, you know, three acts in it. You know, that's the way, that's the difference here between this and Man in the Wilderness. I mean, they really, you feel attacked by a bear, and his sort of naked vulnerability emotionally in that scene is so seamless that I thought, God, how do you sustain that as an actor, you know, then get there? And, you know, with when obviously you're either dealing with a very domesticated animal, you know, and or you're dealing, I didn't realize it might be a guy in a suit, I don't know. But it just felt, you know, the way the scene is created is so energetic and so vibrant. I was really just inside it the whole way.
Yeah.
And I was very impressed when I heard that the sound guy, the fellow building the sound design, you know, took about a month and a half building it from building just a track for that from different angles, you know?
A track for the bear attack scene, you're saying?
Yeah, the bear attack scene was the first thing the sound editor dealt with.
Okay.
And probably the editor of the film, actually. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Foote, I believe. That was who was on stage with them that night.
Uh-huh.
And spoke about having to, you know, build the sound for that scene. And that he was a month and a half doing that for the first month and a half that he was working. He said, and by then I almost had it.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's the kind of detailed, layered work that went into this movie to make it feel effortless.
Yeah,
and that's what you know. I when we were both kind of coming out of that movie as if out of a trance, I think that was what we were really celebrating, was just that we heard all these things about the movie, you know, costing X amount of dollars and taking all these months and all these hardships of filming it, but the feeling of technical hardship disappears when you're watching the movie. There is a sense of hardship in what must be survived, because the film's theme is survival, and it kind of needs to get you inside that in a way that you can't just sit back from.
My sense of the film is that it has, as you say, it is not a narratively driven thing as much as an immersion thing. It's something that you do not watch as much as you really feel that you're living through it. And I think that's probably addressing some more sophisticated and more developed aesthetic than the conventional one of simply rendering a story and the people believe and wait for the second act and all the things that we're accustomed to with storytelling. It's
right.
Working on a higher, more demanding, more involving level in a way that's. But it's funny. But I don't know if you call me crazy or not. But I remember thinking, analogizing it to The Shining on some level, because The Shining's not really much of a story, but it's completely immersive. You really do feel yourself in that hotel and that whole realm.
Right.
And it's really not the greatest story when you think about it. You know, Jack goes crazy, pretty much, is what it is.
Yeah. And that was a point of resistance back when the day the movie opened. But the thing is, you're right. And what it has in common is that the characters are the structure. That's a bold and brave thing for a filmmaker to do. I think Michael Mann did that with Heat as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it you really have in Heat, you have these two men revolving one another, and they're not necessarily opposite sides of one coin, as many people feel. I mean, you know, but they are, they're both driven to a similar degree, and as you have here in The Revenant, you've got really two basically principled characters. You've got, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, whose survival instincts are about his son, really.
Yeah,
and family related. I mean, we begin inside his aesthetic. At the very first part of the movie is sort of an evocation of the inner language of Native American life, which, you know, the Hugh Glass character has absorbed into himself. He's lived among the tribes and has made a life there, and so his sensibility is kind of communal with nature. And the Tom Hardy character, who is, you know, he's, so to speak, the villain for the first third of the picture, but actually what's beautiful and what emerges is that, no, he's a survivor too, and he has an ethic of survival that has a long tradition too, which is me first, you know?
And
the logic of that is very well drawn. I thought that, you know, he expresses this at one sort of moment, and you really understand this man. Mm-hmm. And so now you're in the position of, you know, a Renoir film where there are no villains, where everybody has their reasons. But, okay, whose reason? You know, I think we're more inclined to side with DiCaprio's reason because it's not self-absorbed. You know, it's about...
Well, he was also all but smothered by their callousness and indifference to his faith. That's you know, there isn't a lot of identification with people who did that to him, you know.
Exactly. No, it's true. But you think, how could they do that to him? Mm. And the movie, without straining, answers that. You know, you go, oh, this is how they did it, because they, you know, they're about survival too, but they don't have his large view, and they don't, you know, the complete inability to estimate one another correctly, at least among the people who do the abandoning.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's... It's really quite a beautiful study in survival, and the rage at their indifference is actually part of the fuel that helps him survive. It's a very paradoxical thing that the movie draws. And this, I don't think this spoils it at all, because the twists and turns are so detailed and richly detailed that, you know, people will...
I think I'm right, by the way, and I did notice at one point DiCaprio does eat some sort of inner organ of a of an animal. Wasn't there a buffalo who was half dead and he ate something inside? And he also.
He's eating raw meat and things like that. I guess the wolves attack a buffalo. It's like, yeah. I mean, for me, the essence of the survival, and this is, people can come upon this scene as they will. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, as a, you know, opening an animal and then crawling naked into it to from a snowstorm. Geez Louise, you know, and you're with it completely in that moment. And so it has, you know, every extremity. And it's interesting because this is a movie largely without dialogue. I mean, the dialogue has to form such a small percentage of what we're looking at. Mm. It's right up there with 2001 and Psycho in terms of being really, you know, a latter day silent film.
Well, I got to tell you, FX, I was sitting with a couple of women friends, and they were having a pretty difficult time with that film. And I think where they divorced and went, oh, that's too much. I think that's about it. All we want to take is the scene where the poor horse has been killed and Leonardo guts him. And, you know, that was
crawl
like...
Crawl in, yeah.
That was like, okay, that's where we part company. And, you know, I was fascinated by it, but I was like going, oh, my goodness. And frankly, at the very, very end, there's a confrontation... that I believe this is the scene or the footage or the last few minutes that was shot in Argentina, which is Tom Hardy and DiCaprio having their mano a mano in the snow at the very
right.
end. I do not know, but I believe that might have been the part filmed in Argentina. Maybe.
I believe it is, yes. That's what I read as well, that the production went long, and it was still winter in Argentina, so they could get down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the snow was off the ground in Calgary, Alberta, where they were otherwise shooting, you know?
It got warmer suddenly, and they lost the snow. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I mean, what can I say? It is so difficult to imagine what it must be to shoot a picture like that, because the movie makes it look effortless, but the survival looks effortful. They managed to catch just the reality. My own feet were freezing watching this movie, you know, just because it evokes the sensual, the sense memory of actual cold. And I think that's part of the difficulty with the moment with the horse. It's, you know, do you understand completely why he's doing it? But it's, oh my God, this too? Yeah, but you have to, you know, there's no going back, you know.
And I'll tell you, when I was about, I would say in the vicinity of 15, maybe 16, I was, it was cold out, and it was, I was sort of dressed for it, you know. But I was on ice skates on a pond, and I drifted over to an area, and I started to hear cracking sounds, and I got down very fast in a kind of a supine position, and right then the ice gave way, boom! And I went right in, and I pulled myself out immediately, but I wasn't a, you know, concern. But I was, and then I had to basically, I didn't have a bike, so I basically had to walk home. I've never felt that close to hypothermia, and I felt like I would die if I had to walk any more than a couple miles. I mean, it was awful. And this is, Leonardo goes into the water a lot with his, And I just was kept thinking about how horrifically uncomfortable.
Yes.
You know,
and you get it fast. I mean, I worked on a little film for a friend a few years back, mm-hmm. you know, which involved shooting in Vermont as, you know, just at the beginning of winter. And, and I had to be exposed in that to my skin at a certain point just for the story. And I was like, I got hypothermia, and man, it's within 15 minutes I had it. And it's like, I was an hour and a half to 2 hours shaking it under a hot hot shower, you know?
Yeah.
You know, there's no, mm-hmm. I mean, you can't mess around with that stuff. It's mm-hmm. it takes you over fast, and you don't always know that you're
rendering,
you know?
My second worst experience with hypothermia, waiting outside of a party in Park City during the Sundance Film Festival. And the publicist, God bless her, didn't let me in. And I was thinking, well, I'll just hang out here and everything. And I was got into talking, but it got colder and colder. And then I started to think, Jesus, there's no taxis around here. They won't let me into the party.
Yeah.
And I realized, I got to the point that I was... I really was not feeling my fingers, and I was my joints were starting to numb up, and it really does take you. You know, you don't realize it at first, but then you're in trouble. You know.
Right, right.
She finally let me in. It was like, oh my God!
Yeah.
You know, when I finally got in, it was like terrible. I went right to the fire and just shivered for the next half hour. You know.
Oh man. Yeah.
Anyway, listen. I think yeah. what's happening is that. If you have any love, any affection for really well-made, right in the midst of it, realism of this sort, not to mention the dazzling cinematography by Emmanuel Lubezki, but not to mention the... Jack Fisk did productions. I believed every single frame of this thing, and then some, but it is not an easy sit. It is a rough... time to watch this, not because of boredom, not because of lack of rooting interest. Obviously, you want to see something happen. You believe that Leonardo DiCaprio will probably survive, but it's a rough, brutal realm. And I'll tell you, at the very end, I started to say to myself, when they started to fight again at the very, very end, I was saying to myself, are they going to do this again? Are they going to start, you know, I got a little tired of it, frankly. I said, is there any peace in this world? No, apparently not, because back we go into the, you know, more knives, more cutting, more everything. And I just it's going to, there's a limit that you can take this kind of stuff. And I was saying to myself, you know, I'm, as much as I'm going to see it again on Thursday. I mean, I'm just fascinated by it, but it's not the most pleasant sit. I got to say that.
Well, you know, I think that it's interesting about the climax, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but you're right. There's a moment where we're all winded. The characters are winded. And the feeling of disbelief of, oh, my God, we have to do this again, is it actually works because it's inside the characters. The characters themselves have reached a point. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a kind of moral equilibrium that's being asserted in that moment, because there's a point where I believe that the film is fundamentally challenging the whole notion of vengeance and that vengeance has any meaning. And so I think in order for us to be conducted to that point, you know, the characters and we have to wear out on the idea of a fight, even with more fighting to be done, so that, you know, a certain, so that the balance can shift as it needs to. Now that's, you know, people can argue with that after they've seen the film. I don't want to go into more detail about that moment. But I think you and I are both tuning into something that Iñárritu has let stand inside the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other aspect, too, is, you know, I saw it with a woman friend who was, she reacted to everything. And she's a tough viewer at the same time. But she felt, and she was full of appreciation for the movie and loved it, but did not feel that she could see it again. Which I think you and I mean, I'm ready to see it again. I'm ready to take some friends. I mean, you got to see this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, and you raised the issue. I mean, you said this is not at all an Academy movie, which I can sort of see from, you know, from that kind of racetrack viewpoint that one can adopt about the Oscars and what are the likeliest kind of candidates, you know. And yet, I must say, the experience of the movie has stayed with me so much over the past week that I think if enough voters see it with enough lead time, it may stay with them in such a way that they're going to honor it somehow. Because I think DiCaprio's performance really gains in memory, and Tom Hardy too. I mean, Tom Hardy is up against, you know, he's up against the Hardy twins in Legend. You know, he's both crazed. So I, you know, but as a best supporting nominee, I mean, I can see him as sort of inevitable. I don't know, but I think that they're both doing such great work, and they're doing they're acting, you know, from behind their eyes, as they must, because there's not enough to say, but one can only do, and yet you're totally inside it. I think they may surprise us, you know, in terms of what, you know, the effect, the emotional effect they have long range on Academy numbers.
I will completely agree with you that the DiCaprio performance has stayed with me. It is not something that you just kind of say, well, that was good, then you move on. It does stick to you, and it makes me, that's part of the reason I can't wait to see it again.
Yeah.
But it's, there's the immersive thing that is just as far as the anguish, the agony, the pain that he goes through. But I,
you believe he's come back from the dead.
Yeah, I completely...
Another thing to play.
Yeah, you know? I agree. You know what I was trying to do after I saw the film? I was so in love with Ryuki Sakamoto's music, which is, has maybe three notes in it? He keeps repeating the same thing over and over again.
I know.
But it's really right wonderful,
note.
You know? Just had the greatest time.
What a three note.
Yeah. I mean, he hits it really hard, and it is, I believe, it was symphonic what we were listening to. We were listening to a symphony orchestra of some sort, but it was really, I mean...
Now, if I'm not mistaken, his music also occurs in The Last Emperor, right? That's one of his previous scores, and I know that, of course, he plays as an actor. He was an amazing Japanese camp commandant in Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, opposite David Bowie.
Which he also did the music for, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny.
He's a giant.
He's the one who was in love with David Bowie, right?
Yeah, exactly so.
Right.
Exactly so.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And,
you know, it's, I mean, yeah, how wonderful to find him, you know, out of that extreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really, it's a fantastic, fantastic combination of talents.
I also, though, have to say that I don't anticipate for all the, for all the fascination and the wonderment that you and I and people like who have our share our passion for film are going to feel, I don't think it's going to make very much money. Because I think it's going to... I got in trouble, you may have heard. I got beaten up by jackals after that screening because I had the... I wasn't smart enough. I should have said, is not going to play with over 40 industry women. Instead, I said the words, forget women seeing this, because of my DP friend who was sitting next to me, ducking her head, hiding her, she literally was down on the seat half the time or often. I mean, at one point I kicked her. I said, come on, you know, you can't keep, like, looking at the floor. I mean, give some, show some respect for what they're trying to do here. And then, you know, my friend Sasha Stone, she was, you know, calling it brutal, and she'll find. And then Pete Hammond, who you know from, he was talking about his wife, Madeline.
Sure.
And if it's a Madeline movie, we have this little code thing. If it's a Madeline movie, it's probably going to do well with the Academy, and it's going to do well with, you know, with women and with, you know. And he said she would not last 5 minutes with this movie.
I don't know. You know, I hesitate to join that generalization. I think a lot. I'd be interested in the woman who's eager to see it more than once.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because that's the key. I think that what you have here is a movie that I think anybody would be curious to see it at least once, because it does test your endurance in the best way. It's not like a test of endurance like you're fighting boredom. You're never fighting boredom. But you are.
Never.
I mean, you're constantly being ambushed by, you know, fresh experience. I mean, for example, the battle sequence with which this movie opens, just to deal with it artistically. I mean, there, you know, all the technical chops that Iñárritu develops doing Birdman are applied to a very different purpose in that battle scene, and yet the battle, it much as a kind of a notch up from, say, Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
So we are located inside a battle for real, it feels like, because we're not cutting away. There are, I mean, I know that he feathered the cuts and pulled all kinds of crazy, I guess it was the choreography that they worked out in such advance, so that everything, every head turn is perfectly choreographed, so that you are moving from one disaster to another without a break. And that is a phenomenal...
Even the camera whips up to up in the trees when this attack is going on, because apparently there's some Native Americans up in the trees firing arrows from 50 feet
up. Yeah,
they've
been concealed up there, and that's where the arrows are coming from. Hello. You know, and it's the... What it does is, you know, like Orson Welles pointed out when someone was asking him about why he does these lengthy, complex masters, because he said you live inside the scene better. It creates tension.
Yeah.
That you're not even aware of why the tension is there. And I believe that is very much in the case there in that opening battle sequence, because you are living that battle.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, across the board, I believe that moviegoers are interested in experience now. They're interested in something that they haven't seen before. So I think that I would not sell that. I would not.
Exactly. That's what I would. That's what I would hope that people.
Yeah.
You know, that they would get beyond. Oh, that's a little rough. Except like I was feeling at the end. But the entire movie is so engrossing on that level alone. Just to something you really never quite seen the measure. Something like this. Something is exacting. Something is just really devastating in so many fascinating ways.
I mean, I think, if you look at the popularity of the novels of Cormac McCarthy, which do the same kind of dynamic, there's tons of violence but in a poetically envisioned universe.
Yeah.
That's very much what The Revenant is serving up.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, well, here's hoping. I mean, I hope that it does better than I sensed it might. I certainly don't want Steve Golan and Alejandro and the people who finance this film to take a bath or anything, but it is an expensive film. It cost about $135, not to mention marketing. So
yeah, well, every penny wound up on screen. So let's hope that they, you know, I think that because it does offer something real.
Yeah. Exactly.
And movies succeed. You know, sometimes based on what people are talking about and what people are thinking about and what people kind of need at the present moment.
Yep.
I think with the world so destabilized that there's, you know, and people are interested in survival. And so here's a parable of survival.
Yeah.
So there, this movie has a tremendous edge. I think, oddly enough, I mean, a weird counterpart, I don't know if you've caught it yet, but the movie Joy, directed by David
Oldfield. I caught it.
An ecstatic movie.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but it is also about survival, and it is also pretty about survival of one's spirit when everything else is crushing in on you.
Yeah.
And I think that movie is going to do spectacularly, I think, and I wouldn't be surprised if the two films, Joy and The Revenant, both do very well because of this anxiety and uncertainty that's out there, which both serve to heal. You don't come out of The Revenant feeling more anxious than you went in. You feel really, you know, you come out like you've made a fist with your own mind. You survived together with DiCaprio, and I think that's to the benefit of the film and us.
Yeah. No, I was pretty happy with Joy. I thought that it was. I liked how specific it felt. And I believe the it's funny, it has a tonal shift. In the beginning, I would say the first, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, however long it takes to get around to the actual designing and marketing of the mop, which is never, incidentally, FX, ever spoken of or referred to as the miracle mop. That term never escapes anyone's lips, as far as I noticed. Did you?
No, and Joy's last name is never in there. So the movie was over before I realized I'd seen a true story. You know, I mean, it just felt authentic and crazy the way life is, and I love that about it too. You know, I could not have guessed from scene to scene where the movie was going, and you know, I've come to expect that almost from a David O. Russell film, and yet, and I went in optimistic because of all the talent involved, but at the same time, from one beat to the next, I could not guess how it was going to get, where it was going to go next, and I was always, you know, thrilled and satisfied by where it went. And to a degree, you know, I mean, The Revenant, yeah, you know that there's a huge crisis coming, he's going to have to survive it, but I couldn't tell what the next scene would contain.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell what kind of choices people were going to make.
Right.
I was constantly being surprised by characters or by their understandings of things. That was the surprise about Tom Hardy's character. I feel that's probably why he got on board and felt challenged by this role. And you know, anyway, it just was, you know, I think that if a storyteller has the strength and the guts to surprise themselves, whatever it takes to do that, then, you know, they're you know, then they're really creating something of such value that people will show up. Mm. And I think that's what's happened here.
Mm. By the way, are you doing any more books along the lines of that wonderful book you did on Roman Polanski? Are you doing anything?
Oh, well, I have a book out on Orson Welles that's out right now called Orson Welles, Power, Heart, and Soul, which right. came out this year for the centenary.
Right.
And I'm looking forward to, you know, the next thing I'll be doing for the Critical Press will deal with Z-Channel in some way. I'm now formulating that. And
what would that be? What do you mean a Z-Channel thing? What are you talking about?
Oh, well, you know, years ago, Zan Cassavetes did that documentary, Z-Channel.
Yeah, that was wonderful. I love that doc.
So
yeah.
I'm creating, they've invited me to put together all my writings for Z-Channel, and in doing that, I'm creating a memoir to go with it, so that's what I'm up to right this moment. But, you know, and I'm trying to get beyond, you know, I mean, Zan's film is so wonderful, it speaks for itself. I don't have to improve on it in any way.
Right.
And there's a fellow named Samuel Prime who's doing a kind of biography of Z. So I can just basically concentrate on the movies and, you know, certain experiences that were related to the Z-Channel experience. So
okay.
I'm finding that book right now. Mm. But but the Welles book is out there. It just came out, and, you know, for the centenary. And I think what's unusual about the book is that I'm trying to deal with a couple of things. One is Welles' politics, which people tend to, they tend to know he was liberal and progressive, but don't realize how serious he was,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how productive he was right up to the night he died.
Right,
so,
right. You know, I gave $100, I donated $100, and I thought that to the finishing of The Other Side of the Wind. But I'll tell you, I'm not persuaded that every one of our colleagues did the same or felt the same. There's some skepticism that I had picked up about it, but
I don't think people are skeptical with the film itself. I hope they're not, because I've seen enough of that film. I saw about 3 hours of footage that Gary Graver showed me back in 1998. There's a movie there, you know, and, you know, in the right hands, it basically, as Welles himself, he edited 47 minutes fine cut. So that's,
mm-hmm.
you have 47 minutes of Welles at his top-notch, crazy, wild, visionary early 1970s. And then you've got all the material for the rest is there, sort of like the manuscript for F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Last Tycoon. You can create something that adds to the canon.
Last Tycoon
adds to the body of work of F. Scott Fitzgerald. It's there. The whole thing that's tied it up, I mean, Josh Karp does a beautiful job of drawing upon this in his book, about, which is strictly about Other Side of the Wind, about everybody that gets involved. There's Welles, and then there's the entourage of interests around him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been a confused and confusing story. And it seems that, you know, to the bitter end, these conflicting interests and conflicting whatevers are just sort of forming a weird ring around this little tropical island that is this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So the skepticism that I pick up on is, can we liberate it this time? It's not, you know, we've all heard this before, so it becomes, you know, a weird, you know, elusive object, a kind of holy grail.
I got to tell you, FX, when you said the words fine cut just now, I wasn't aware that he had completed what he considered to be a very full and complete cut for what it was, at least the portion of the film that he cut together. That means that a person who's with any skills at editing would know exactly more or less how to put the rest of it together, because they'd have to simply follow the tone and the pacing and the attitude of that fine cut. It shouldn't be that difficult. I mean, everything's hard, but it shouldn't be insurmountable.
No, it's a matter of, you know, the Munich, the guys at the Munich Archive did what they called a best guess edit of Mr. Arkadin, you know, because, you know, about 8 hours of material was found, and from that, you know, you can actually build, based on Welles' original sketches and, you know, his script, you can build, as they have done for the Criterion Collection, a coherent Mr. Arkadin, which, I mean, is streets ahead of anything else we've seen before, you know, that film.
Right.
And it's, as they say, a best guess edit. It's not the director's cut, quote unquote. But the footage helps you to guess. And there is a best guess edit in The Other Side of the Wind that can definitely be put out there. And I think people would enjoy it. It, you know, there's several things happen. I mean, you've got people wanting to be adequately rewarded for all the time they put in protecting the film, so you have to throw these dragons to slay in terms of, you know, how to pay off the various people involved. I think pretty much everybody's at the table now, from what I understand. So, right. So that's there. And then the other thing that's a problem, it's a minor problem, but it's the expectations that build. You begin to expect divine revelation when what Welles was making was a kind of lighthearted film in the spirit, I mean, in a tradition of, say, 8 and a half or All That Jazz. He was trying to come up with, you know, a busy, crazy vaudeville about a so-called great director played by John Huston. Mm-hmm. And in fact, not just so-called, he's one of the lions of movies, but at the same time, in 1970, he's having enough of an inner crisis that he's just questioning everything. And I think that's very close to who Welles was at most times of any given day. Mm. So what you have there is a kind of lighthearted tap dance and a kind of comedy, a poetic comedy that, you know, I think a good editor can certainly do justice to. Yeah. You know, and I think that I hope that when audiences see it, that they understand that it was meant to be, you know, just mm-hmm. right between Chimes at Midnight and F for Fake. You know, it's a it's part of the body of work, and it's not divine revelation. It's just a fine piece of Welles at his top, sure. on top of his game.
Can I ask, are you going to see The Hateful Eight this week? Are you looking forward to that?
Yes, I'm going to be seeing Hateful Eight on Friday night, I believe, yeah. And I'm looking forward to that.
I'm very excited about the Ultra Panavision 70 process, which I said recently that I have not really seen in a theater. I've seen it on Blu-ray and DVD when I've watched Ben-Hur and the 62 Mutiny on the Bounty, and I forget, it was Raintree County. But the full width of that... that 2.76:1, which is, you know, pretty close to 3:1. That's really, really quite wide and quite novel in our theatrical experience these days.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. When I mean, Lawrence of Arabia, does that qualify? Or
no, that was Super Panavision, and that was 2.2:1.
Ah, boy. And I know that. I mean, Kenneth Branagh shot his Hamlet 65mm. I don't know what the lens or the ratios were, but I believe he must have been just sort of working from a David Lean playbook on that one.
Mm. So, to my knowledge, David Lean never shot in Ultra Panavision. Super and Ultra are different things.
Oh, boy. Oh, I can't wait. That's a gas unto itself. I mean, yeah. You know, it's a very interesting phase we're in movies because, I mean, Quentin Tarantino is ideal for that kind of curatorship of, mm-hmm. of techniques and things like that. And I think we're getting to this point where filmmakers are a lot like graphic artists. You know how an artist today can work in stone or copper engraving, or sure. used to work in oils or acrylics. You know, mm-hmm. it's the same sort of palette as being is emerging in the hands of filmmakers.
Yeah. All right, pal, this is great. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me, and I hope that more people than I am anticipating, and I hope that you're more right than me about the appetite and the interest that people will have in The Revenant, because it certainly is a novel experience. I don't think anybody who sees it can say, oh, I've seen this kind of thing before. Not like
right,
this.
Right, yeah.
Not like this.
Yeah.
You know?
No. Quite right.
Yeah.
Okay, Jeff, thanks so much. You take
care. All right, thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.